Earlier today, the United States Supreme Court heard arguments on the Solomon Amendment, a federal law that would threaten colleges and universities with loss of federal funds if they deny military recruiters access to their campuses. Schools across the country argued that they have a First Amendment right to deny recruitment to any employer that discriminates against gays and lesbians, and that includes the military. Paul Clement is United States Solicitor General. He presented the government side of the argument and presented it this way.
The Solomon Amendment conditions the federal funding of educational institutions on receiving something that any donor would expect, the opportunity to recruit students educated at the funded institutions. That opportunity allows the military a fair shot at recruiting the best and the brightest for the military's critical and vital mission. The federal government does not insist on any predetermined level of access. Rather, it simply asks what other employers receive. Likewise, the recipient schools remain free to criticize the military and its policies, and of course they remain free to decline federal funds altogether. As a result of these circumstances, the Solomon Amendment comports with both the Constitution and with common sense.
Joining us now on the line from his office is David Savage, legal correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and a regular guest on this program. David, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Neil.
And as I understand it, the other side, the universities, were arguing that they do not allow any recruiter to discriminate in their employment against anybody, and their argument is the military does discriminate.
Yes, that's right. It was particularly the law schools that were making this argument. A number of law schools, the Association of American Law Schools, have had a policy going back at least 10 years of saying they don't want to have employers who have discriminatory policies, including discrimination based on sexual orientation. So if you're a private company and you refuse as a matter of policy to hire gays or lesbians, you can't recruit at that law school. The law schools say the military is the same. It violates our policy, and we should not have to implicitly endorse the military's discrimination by hosting military recruiters at our law schools.
And the Solomon Amendment, after this situation sort of escalated, this was a situation at law schools, and then the Solomon Amendment was passed, and it was applied to the universities as a whole.
That's right. The Solomon Amendment applies to the universities as a whole. It's the law schools that have essentially challenged it. So the policy applies to all colleges and universities, but this actual challenge arose from a coalition of law schools.
Let's hear a little bit about the argument from the other side. We'll listen to Joshua Rosenkranz, who argued the case for the universities challenging the Solomon Amendment. Let's hear what he had to say.
In this case, what Congress has done is to engage in the most viewpoint-oriented regulation of speech. The reason Congress is insisting that the law schools disseminate the recruiting messages is because of the message of the law schools themselves.
It doesn't insist that you do anything. It says that if you want our money, you have to let our recruiters on campus.
Yes, Your Honor, and under the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions, the analysis is exactly the same.
What about South Dakota against Dole? South Dakota had a constitutional right under the 21st Amendment to set whatever drinking age it wanted, and yet we upheld the spending clause condition that if they accepted federal funds, they had to set their drinking age at 21.
Yes, Your Honor, and in subsequent cases, and in fact in Dole itself, this court pointed out that all bets are off when there's a superseding constitutional right. Here we're talking about the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment. I mean, Rosenberger and Rust.
There's the right to, in the Constitution, to raise a military.
Well, that is a government interest, for sure. All government interests can be traced.
What you're arguing is that what is, for all intents and purposes, conduct can be infused by the school at its option with a First Amendment quality. Your argument would allow schools to exclude anybody in uniform from a cafeteria.
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Because, why not?
Because
the point.
What the law schools are engaging
solely for an expressive purpose.
Your Honor, there's a difference between refusing to abide by a universally applicable regulation of conduct on the one hand and the Solomon Amendment on the other hand, which is refusing to assist the dissemination of a message.
And there we heard Joshua Rosenkrantz, as well as the new Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, and Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy. And David Savage, they were giving him a hard time there.
Yes, they sure were. It started bad for Rosenkrantz and never got any better. The two snippets you heard there, I think, illustrated two of the problems with his argument. One is the federal funding issue. John Roberts said several times, well, if the universities or law schools don't like this, just don't take the federal funds. This is a condition, this is a spending condition. And Justice Kennedy was sort of troubled, as many of them were. It was sort of, what's the free speech violation here? The universities and the law schools remain free to criticize the military's policy. Clement even said during the argument is they could stand there and protest when military recruiters arrive on campus and say, we disagree with the military's policy. So I think the justices were simply not convinced that this is a free speech First Amendment issue.
Justice Stephen Breyer at one point wondered whether a university would have the same right to restrict access to military recruiters because the school opposed the Pentagon's advocacy of racial diversity.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, for a very long time, the federal government, Congress, has said, you colleges and universities, if you take federal money, you may not do a number of things. Like, for example, in the 1960s, you may not discriminate against black students. And Breyer was sort of saying, gee, if abiding by non-discrimination means a sort of adopting a message or a viewpoint we disagree with, well, gee, a racist private school back in the 60s could have said, oh, we don't have to abide by the civil rights laws because it violates our free speech rights. It's sort of a strained argument.
There was another lively snippet of conversation between Joshua Rosenkrantz, again arguing for the universities, and Justices O'Connor and Chief Justice Roberts on the issue of why law schools can't make their own policy clear. Let's hear some of that.
But the government takes the position that the law school is entirely free to convey its message to everyone who comes.
Yes, Justice O'Connor. And
so how is the message affected in that environment?
Let me answer in two parts. First, of course, under the compelled speech cases, the ability to protest the forced message is never a cure for a compelled speech violation. But what's going on is,
I'm sorry, but on compelled speech, nobody thinks that the law school is speaking through those employers who come onto its campus for recruitment. Everybody knows that those are the employers. Nobody thinks the law school believes everything that the employers are doing or saying.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, endorsement is also not an element of a compelled speech claim. But let me bring those two questions together on a factual point. The law schools are disseminating a message that they believe it is immoral to abet discrimination.
But when they can say that to every student who enters the room.
And when they do it, Your Honor, the answer of the students is, we don't believe you. We read your message as being that there are two tiers. There's a
but
double
there a student? The reason they don't believe you is because you're willing to take the money. What you're saying is this is a message we believe in strongly, but we don't believe in it to the tune of $100 million.
That's right, Your Honor. And the problem with this Solomon Amendment is that the unconstitutional conditions doctrine says that you can't put a private speaker to that crisis of conscience.
May I just be sure?
And that was, again, Joshua Rosenkrantz arguing for the law schools and the universities. David Savage, a little unusual to hear the Chief Justice of the United States get laughs.
Well, he certainly sort of put the issue pointedly several times, as you don't have to take the money. I just think Rosenkrantz's argument about unconstitutional conditions is a little bit strained here. I mean, you can imagine, for example, if Congress would pass a law that says colleges and universities that take federal funds may not criticize George Bush or the war in Iraq. I think all of us would say, yes, that's a free speech violation. You can't sort of put a university and a college to that test.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, they're saying you're free to criticize the military. You just have to allow military recruiters to come on campus just like other employers. And I think, as I say, the justices never could see how that was a free speech violation.
Yet the argument could then be extended to say Congress could pass a law that says universities and colleges that take federal money can't perform abortions in their university hospitals.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, there are a lot of spins on how this argument could play up, but I think the Supreme Court's general rule is that if you take federal money, they can put a lot of, the government can put a lot of conditions on you. As an exchange, you take the money, you have to abide by the condition. But the court in the past has said in a few cases, you can't force people to give up basic constitutional rights like free speech. I just think this is one that they're going to say it's not a, the universities are not being infringed in their right to speak freely.
And was the extension of initially the stricture on federal funds applied just to the law schools, which where the case first came up, and then it was applied to the university at large? Was that an issue?
No. This really is a law school's challenge. The money goes to the universities, but there was really no focus on that issue of this is law schools challenging a policy that really applies to the university. I should also say, Neil, there was almost no discussion of the sort of underlying issue of the military's discrimination against gays. The Supreme Court has never squarely ruled on that issue. A lot of people think it violates the Equal Protection Clause, but this argument really didn't focus on that underlying discrimination by the military. It focused only on this sort of free speech question.
So it didn't address whether don't ask, don't tell amounts to discrimination.
Yes, that's right. I think the Supreme Court's going to rule for the government and the military, but it really won't tell us much about their view of the underlying policy.
So this was not, in that sense, a proxy argument about don't ask, don't tell.
Yes, that's right, because I think even the liberal justices are going to side with the military here, but I think if the case comes directly before them, they're going to be troubled by the military's discriminatory policy.
We're talking about arguments before the Supreme Court today on the so-called Solomon Amendment, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. Doug. Doug is calling us from Crozet. Is that how it's pronounced?
Crozet,
Virginia.
Yes. Hi. I enjoy the show. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a quick question about the broader application of the Solomon Amendment. I'm a pastor of a United Methodist Church, and one of the additional responsibilities I have is for the recruitment of new clergy. And I'm wondering if it sounds to me like if this were passed the way the universities would like to see it happen, we couldn't recruit at job fairs either, because I know there's some churches, for instance, that the United Methodist Church isn't one, but some churches don't ordain women, some churches don't ordain homosexuals. So would that mean that we wouldn't have access to, like, college or university job fairs for talking about ordained ministry as a career or as a vocation, within the light of this particular amendment? And I'll just take the answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Doug.
Thank you.
I don't think that's going to become a problem. I think it could become a problem if the university and the law schools were able to win on their claim that we have a particular right, constitutional right, to sort of enforce our own view on others. But I don't, since I think they're going to lose, I don't think I don't think it's going to apply to possibly apply to other people like churches and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. David, let me ask you a couple of questions sort of on the periphery of this. We've been all, of course, carefully watching initial performances of the new Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, just confirmed in September, or I guess in October. He seemed to be, it was September, I'll correct myself, he seemed to be extremely active in this discussion.
Yes, in most of the arguments I've sat through, he's been right on top of the issue, has asked very pointed questions. He knows exactly what, he's really studied the cases and goes right to the heart of the issue. I mean, right away in this case, he went to the two big issues, which is the federal funding issue. You took the money. You have to go along with the conditions. And the other, which is, what's the free speech problem here? I've just been impressed with every argument I've been to, some of the small cases, some of the big cases. He's right on top of the issues, very quick, very pointed. He doesn't ask these sort of long-winded, Justice Breyer frequently asks very interesting questions, but they take 5 minutes to get out. They're sort of a long hypothetical. Roberts, just like when he was a lawyer, he was known for very succinct, concise answers, got right to the point, and he's like that as a so far as Chief Justice.
We also heard from Associate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who, as everybody knows, wants to retire. She's awaiting the confirmation of a replacement, and that's still in process. Is she as engaged as she has been in previous years, do you think?
Yes, every bit as much so. I mean, you heard some of the exchanges in that case. she doesn't sound like somebody who's leaving. She too seems very engaged in the cases. She's not just sitting back and listening and watching. She has a very strong view in a number of those cases and asks. She also asks sort of very direct questions. You know exactly what she's thinking. And there's no, if you knew nothing else, you would have no hint in watching in the courtroom that she's, on the verge of retiring.
And one other question. Up until this new court session, we got audio, same-day audio of Supreme Court arguments twice, Bush v. Gore and the affirmative action cases involving the University of Michigan and the University of Michigan Law School, big cases that everybody knew were going to be important. And now we've gotten same-day audio tape twice in 2 weeks.
I think that's a little hint of the Roberts Court. He seems very open to, certainly more open than Chief Justice Rehnquist was, than being cooperative with the press and allowing the public to have a sort of greater view of what goes on in the Supreme Court. I will say all the justices that I remember talking to in the past said that they thought the audio experiment worked well. That is, they thought it was wonderful that the public that was interested could listen to the arguments and that they were going to do it somewhat more often. And some of the media groups have asked John Roberts, and he's right away said yes, he's amenable to getting that tape out very quickly. So I suspect we'll see this more often in the year ahead.
David Savage, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
David Savage, legal affairs correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and he joined us on the phone from his offices here in Washington, D.C. More on this story coming up later today on All Things Considered. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan.